Welcome to Top Advisor Marketing, where you will learn how to become a prolific online influencer, attract more ideal clients, and grow your practice. Brought to you by Top Advisor Podcasting, a done-for-you podcasting solution built just for trusted advisors. And now, your co-hosts of Top Advisor Marketing, Kirk Lowe and Matt Halloran.
Hello and welcome to another podcast. Today we have a very, very special guest. In fact, we're going to be going massively international here. We're going to be interviewing Prasad Ramani, who is where today? Prasad, where are you located?
Hi, Matt. I'm today in Dubai.
You're in Dubai. All right. Kirk, where are you at today?
I'm in Toronto, as always. And it's raining again.
Is it really?
It's been raining on and off for 2 months now.
Yeah. So, Prasad, I mean, how much rain are you guys getting there? Do you guys get a lot of rain?
That's not a problem for us here at all.
That's absolutely fantastic.
If you want to talk about internationalism, right? My partner, who's the chief science officer, he sits in London. Huh. I have a couple of researchers in California. My tech team is in India, and my business development guy is in New York.
Wow. So that's absolutely fantastic. A real true 21st century business. And, you know, as a marketing podcast here, what we're going to talk about today is very interesting, because not only do you have a very interesting brand, but you made a major switch. So first off, tell everybody what your official title is, please.
Sure. I'm the founder and chief executive officer of Syntonic, and we are a behavioral finance-based startup that develops tools for financial advisory.
Okay, so Syntonic, though, that's a very interesting word. Do you mind telling us where you got that from and what it means?
Not so. Yeah, sure. The original word Syntonic, with a C at the end, stands for being in harmony with your environment. Mm. And what we did, we switched the C to a Q to make it seem like being in harmony with your financial situation using your IQ and EQ. So it's a Syntonic with a Q at the end.
Gotcha. Now, you started off as a quantitative finance guy. How did you make this move, Prasad? I mean, this just seems like a big shift to me.
Yeah, it is a very interesting story behind this. My background for the last 16 years has been on the quantitative side of things, basically on portfolio optimization, risk management, and across the wealth management services. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years back, I was with a major global investment office as the head of quantitative analysis, and I was doing some portfolio analysis on our losses, and I was trying to figure out how to mitigate them. And the interesting part, after going through like nearly 5 years of meeting notes and research notes and investment documents, the thing that the Eureka moment hit me when I saw that most of these losses were because of behavioral reasons. Hmm. You know, for example, like getting married to our positions or doubling down on bets, being overconfident with our analysis and stuff like that. And, you know, that was a real light bulb moment for me. And that made me switch into behavioral finance. And I spent the next 1.5 years pretty much researching everything that we need to know about behavioral finance and economics and investment decision making. And that's how I got into this.
What a fantastic transition, in a logical transition, even though that it might not seem like that on the surface. So you just touched on why behavioral finance is so important. But do you mind if we dive into that a little deeper and unpack that a little bit more, Prasad?
Sure, sure. So behavioral finance, I mean, I'm sure you've started seeing a lot more of behavioral finance in the last few years, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in the last like 3-4 years. And one major reason for that is behavioral finance talks about psychological principles that underlie our financial decision-making, especially when it comes to investments and retirement planning. So it basically combines cognitive psychology with conventional finance to help us understand why we make irrational decisions.
So let's talk about the irrational decisions. You outlined a couple of those right at the beginning. Can you outline what those are?
Sure. So for example, you know, some irrational decisions, which I'm sure you might have seen or probably you might even have, done by yourself, is stuff like, say, overconfidence. When you overestimate your ability, to come up with some precise forecasts for the stocks that you hold, or loss aversion, especially when you're thinking of a risky payoff, right, a risky investment, you tend to focus more on the losses than on the potential gains. And then you have stuff like disposition effect, where you end up selling losers, where you, sorry, end up selling winners more easily than losers, mm-hmm. and keep holding on to your losers. So these are very typical investing behaviors, especially in the retail landscape.
Okay. How do you control this, though, Prasad? I mean, this sounds really human.
Yeah, no, this is a fantastic question that you have come up with. The core principle behind behavioral finance is that is to become more self-aware. So if you want to control these biases or control these behavioral issues, for example, you need to have an above average level of self-awareness. And the way you do that is first by trying to understand why you're making these mistakes in the first place, what are the reasons behind that, and how do you put in place systems that can help you prevent from, you know, falling into this type of biases.
And I can't wait to dive into that a little bit more, because I have a strong feeling that the tools that you've created are going to be a magnificent difference maker and selling tool for advisors specifically to say, this is a problem and we're one of the only people who have the opportunity to solve it. But I want to keep diving into behavioral finance a little bit deeper. So sure. How does this impact client investment behavior? And I'm going to add a little caveat to that, which is, and how they interact with their advisors. Because you just talked about being married to the positions, you know, doubling sure. down, all of that stuff. How, help us with that.
Sure. Now let's take a step back, right? Let's figure out why do we make irrational decisions in the first place? Because the last, like say, 80, 90, 100 years of conventional finance assumes that investors are rational people. Now the reason we make irrational decisions is because of something called bounded rationality. To give you a very simple example, let's assume that your wardrobe has about, say, 25, 30 pieces of different types of clothing, right? Now, the permutations that you can come up with to wear those different combinations in different orders can run into millions. But your brain is a fantastically beautiful information processing machine, and what it does is it cuts through all this nonsense and picks out the right combination to wear in less than a minute, right? Now, this is a great way for the brain to operate efficiently. Now, because it is operating very efficiently, it has to take some shortcuts. And these shortcuts, when you don't pay attention to the shortcuts, could end up as biases in your thought process. Do you see how it works now?
I do. I mean, I think it's terrifying, and I understand because I do this. You know, I personally do this all the time. So how does that impact? How do those shortcuts impact investment stuff?
Sure. For example, there is something called anchoring. Yeah. So, for instance, and this is like, I mean, this is unbelievable. There've been a lot of studies done on anchoring, where anchoring stands for this propensity to get stuck with a particular data point. For example, I mean, you would assume that judges are very good at understanding human behavior, right? I mean, hopefully the decisions that judges make are pretty good, right?
I would hope so, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there was this very interesting study that was done in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and even in the 80s. And the people who were studied were criminal judges, right? And what the study basically involved having pretty much the same set of cases with the same set of witnesses, the same issues, the same processes and everything else, right? And just before the criminal judge decided to like give out a judgment, they were asked to roll a pair of dice. And in some cases, the dice was loaded to show a high number, and in some cases, it was loaded to show a low number. Interestingly, the judges who saw a high number, he gave a sentence that was much longer than the judges who saw a low number.
Hmm.
And this is controlling for all other aspects of the case. So this is a situation, and there are many other studies. I'm just quoting one single study. Mm-hmm. There are many other studies that show how the human brain can get latched on to even irrelevant numbers. And anchoring, and imagine if you get latched on to relevant numbers. For example, let's assume that that your colleague or your friend just comes over to you and says, hey, you know what? I made 20% using this strategy last week or last month, right?
Yeah.
Now, immediately, your mind latches on to this 20%, right? And then when you go and discuss some particular strategy with your financial advisor, this 20% is sitting in your background mm-hmm. without your own knowledge. And then if the financial advisor proposes a bond portfolio with, like, say, a 5% or a 6% return, that probably makes sense for you from a portfolio perspective. You suddenly are not interested in that because your mind has latched onto this number 20.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a simple example.
It's interesting that you refer to it as anchoring, because from a coaching and consulting perspective, we use anchoring all the time for very positive results, anchoring an emotion or behavior with a specific experience in order to either increase the power of that or decrease the mental aspect of that. So it's fascinating to me how you're using the same sort of techniques, these behavioral techniques. I mean, this goes all the way back to B.F. Skinner, you know, with the bell and the dog salivating, right? Help me, though, with how do we as financial services professionals really attack this head on? So you've got four different points here on how this impacts client investment. Do you mind going through these four points?
Not at all. Sure. So I think the whole fundamental aspect of financial services, right? The first thing that you talk about is know your client. Now, When somebody says, know your client, what does it mean? I mean, till now, I mean, probably till like 2-3 years back, know your client literally meant like trying to understand where they were coming from, what their risk return expectations were, and basically focus on the numbers. But I think what's happening now, know your client literally means understand your clients behaviorally and try to figure out who they are, how their behavior is, and, you know, what their biases are. Because this is going to be key in terms of managing the portfolio and also in terms of deepening your relationship with the client. Because if you look at your particular portfolio, I mean, even your own portfolio, for instance, a lot of times you'll see that one of the biggest issues and the reasons that you don't end up making the type of returns that you'd like to is not because of anything else. It's because of behavioral stuff. Either you got in too early or you got out too early, or you just try to like overtrade, or you had a lot of overconfidence and things on that. Now, the important thing for a financial advisor then is to manage their clients' behaviors. That, I think, is the key for a successful financial advisor-client relationship. Now, to do that, you have to sit down with the client and you need to talk in common language. You need to have like a foundation for you to talk about. A system, a common language that can speak about behavioral things, and then figure out how it impacts investment decisions. Because, as you know, almost all investment decisions have an emotional background to it.
Absolutely. I mean,
there's a lot of emotions involved. And this has been proven by neurofinance. I mean, they've actually done MRIs and all kinds of scans and stuff to literally scientifically prove that the more important a decision is, and especially financial decisions, it's located in the emotional part of your brain called the limbic system.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea then is to talk about these things, first of all, with your prospective clients or your current clients, and then figure out, okay, so these are the issues we are dealing with. Now, how do we take care of this?
Okay.
So the first part...
Well, hold on. I need to back you up here, Prasad, because I'm trying to figure out... So, you know, a lot of the advisors that we work with, that Kirk and I have worked with over the years, are highly analytical. They really don't think like this. So how do I even trigger my advisor to realize that there are behavioral tendencies within my clients, or even behavioral tendencies within myself, that are making me make these mistakes?
I think one of the best ways to do that is to really think about the way clients react during volatile markets. I mean, just think about this, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, if there's a lot of volatility in the markets, the first thing that a client does is basically just call the financial advisor and have a chat. Now, I'm sure almost all financial advisors out there have, you know, faced the situation where things are not as straightforward as they would like it to be. I mean, emotions are a big part of this particular mm-hmm. relationship. Mm-hmm. And the sooner you address that, the better it is both for you and for your client.
Now, but Syntonic, right? So this company that you've created helps tease some of this stuff out. When we talked before, when we were just, Kirk and I were getting to know you, you had highlighted a number of different tools that you have built into your program here to help advisors, one, obviously self-check themselves, check their clients, and then kind of have a way to address this behaviorally. So do you mind if we dive into that?
Not at all, not at all, sure. There's many, many different angles to this. Yeah, there's many different layers to this. So let me pick one layer, and that is just the topic of behavioral finance itself. Now, let's assume that as an advisor, you know, you go through some books and, you know, you go through some material and you figure out that there are these behavioral issues that you have to take care of, right? Now, that's great. Now, what do you do next? Now, let's assume I tell you, hey, Matt, you need to figure out the overconfidence, anchoring, representativeness levels of your clients and try to advise accordingly. And you're going to say, okay, that's all very well, but how do I figure these things out, right? I mean, that's a problem for you. Now, what we have done is we have created behavioral algorithms that analyzes all these different biases and then comes out with, how should I put it, like various degrees of or various propensities of what the client of a particular client has towards these biases. So for example, let's assume you have two different clients, right? For one client, probably the overconfidence level is very high, the anchoring is low, representativeness is somewhat in between, financial literacy is not great. Now, for this particular client, your approach has to be completely different compared to somebody else whose overconfidence levels are high, the biases, other biases are low, and then the financial literacy levels are high. Mm-hmm. So you have to adjust your approach accordingly for these two clients. You can't like take your same approach and then try to fit it in. And so what we do is using our assessment, which is it's a behavioral psychometric assessment, you can dig deeper into your client's psychological investment profile and then use that as a basis to discuss your approach and also personalize your approach.
Huh. So, Kirk, yeah, as you're listening to this, how are you seeing advisors being able to use what Prasad has created here with his international team to help market and or help brand? What are you hearing here?
A lot of things racing through my head here. I believe that advisors, when they think about growing their businesses and understanding their clients and being and offering more value and doing great work, I mean, what Syntonica has created here is an incredible tool to add a lot of clarity to kind of give a foundation for being better in this area of behavioral finance, which in turn creates better relationships. But there's another angle to this that I find very intriguing, and that is that you've created an assessment that for the most part, most clients will have never experienced in their financial relationships, which is an advisor saying, hey, there could be some biases, emotional biases that lie within you that have hampered your progress financially forever up to this point. And I want to address those. So that's the first one, is just being able to market this idea that this advisor is doing something that nobody's ever done with him or her before. And I think that is very intriguing. The second part is that you can put the ability to put an assessment tool on your website instantly creates this amount of credibility, expertise, and differentiation that most advisors don't ever get to on their websites. Which raises a whole other set of points that I'd like to talk to, but it probably take me 10 minutes and I won't do that now, but on another call, another podcast. But it does allow the opportunity now to use this as a marketing tool, for a lack of a better, you know, word, but to how do we engage people? And, you know, engage is one of our four steps of our blueprint, which is when somebody's on your site, how can you give them something that they can kind of experience and dig into. And this tool does that. Not only is this tool great for those two purposes I just mentioned, the report is so good.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be thinking before you ever look at Syntonic that, oh, these guys are going to be highly technical. This report is going to be very difficult for people to understand and comprehend. That is not true. And I'd like, you know, be a great for advisors to go test this and see what it's like, because I was incredibly impressed with how simple. I've experienced not to an expert level by any means, but I've experienced a number of different tools like this, and I find across the board they are too technical. They're not intuitive and they're not well thought out. And this is gets a high score in all those areas.
So Prasad, was Kirk spot on with that?
Well, thank you very much, Kirk, for those really kind words. But here's the I'm kind of like a little scared right now. You know why? Because Kirk has anchored the expectations to sky high level now.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We need to lower that a bit.
We are marketing guys.
We are. We definitely like that. Making things sound wonderful.
Right. Let me just ask you guys another question, yeah? I mean, based on your discussions with financial advisors, all through these years, what percentage of time do you think that a financial advisor actually spends on advising and looking at portfolios and analysis versus on business development / marketing and / chasing clients?
Kirk, do you want to answer that? It's a depressing number.
This is a trap for sure.
Yeah, it is.
But we got to guess. So, you guess who? If I guess closer in the range, either, yeah, then Matt, you owe me a big frosty beer now.
That's fine. No, I'm totally fine with that.
Okay, and vice versa. So can you ask that question again, Prasad, so I make sure I get it right? Because I'm not losing this bet.
No worries. So what percentage of time do you think financial advisors spend in actually advising and looking at portfolios compared to business development and, chasing prospects and clients?
So a ratio of like two to one or 3 to 1, something like that?
Yeah, 70%, 30%, 50%, 50%, just as a percentage tool will work.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would say 25% of their time managing portfolios and 40% of their time prospecting.
Okay.
But your math doesn't add up there, dude.
Oh, it has to add up to 100?
Well, maybe. Aren't we doing percentages here?
Well, there's not other stuff they do in the day, like managing people?
Sure, but on a relative basis, it's almost like, okay, saying you're saying around 40, 60, yeah? 35,
okay.
65.
Okay, I get the math now. I will say 40, 60.
Okay.
Okay. What about you, Matt? Do you agree to that?
Well, my problem is I actually have to qualify it, because there are three different types of advisors. There's the highly technical advisor. And so the highly technical advisor would be way weighted toward investment management, portfolio management. I'm talking 75-25. And then I would say that there is the middle of the road, more educationally based advisor. And then that would be 50-50. But then I've got the hardcore sales, probably came from insurance business advisor. And then that would be the flip side of 70-25. So they'd be spending way more time prospecting than they would on the portfolio. So Kirk, look, dude, you're going to owe me a beer, because I just broke that down. And I can't be wrong at this point. Okay, Prasad, where are we at?
You cheated so bad.
My God, you guys are very technical for a couple of marketing dudes. All right. So, I agree with you in the sense that the percentage of time spent, and we have done, again, some research on this and we've looked at some studies, the percentage of time spent on prospecting is at least equal to the time spent on actual portfolio management. Now, if you think about this for a sec, right, that's actually a little crazy, because the financial advisor's main role is supposed to be actually looking at, portfolios and advising people and advising clients. They really shouldn't be spending a whole lot of time trying to get clients and trying to convince them of why they need financial advice in the first place. But that's a big issue for financial advisors, because they're selling an intangible service. And more importantly, as marketing people, I'm sure you'd agree, that if I'm a prospect, right, I'm a prospective client, and you come to me and you try selling yourself, subconsciously I'm going to have barriers, and I won't take in what you say as I should. So for example, if you come and tell me, hey Prasad, your finances don't look very good, and we need to like sit down and have a chat, and you need to have a disciplined financial plan and blah, blah, blah. Now, for me, a lot of this just sounds like a marketing talk because I know you're coming to sell me something, right? And because of that red flag that subconsciously arises in me, I'm going to like discount a lot of the stuff that you mentioned and think that, you know what, this is just marketing spiel. And then I might not even decide to go ahead, you know, with a second round or a third round of discussions. Now, because this happens a whole lot, financial advisors end up spending a lot of time trying to convince prospective clients to turn into actual clients. And what we are trying to do is we are trying to reduce this cycle by getting the prospective clients to become more self-aware that they need financial advice. So in a sense, we are trying to change the paradigm of the whole wealth management service from one of financial advisors pushing their services to prospective clients wanting their services. Do you see how it works?
Oh, I'm just in awe of how wonderfully this meshes. And we never even got to this place with our discussions. I mean, how wonderfully this meshes with what we talk about, which is one of the things that we preach a lot is brand depth. Mm-hmm. And that is how can you quickly create enough credibility through your marketing and not selling, but marketing and value and expertise and all those things so that somebody doesn't have, when they get into a meeting with you, they're not thinking, oh, you're all about marketing, because they can see from your site, you've got papers, checklists, you've got a podcast, you've got videos. And then all of a sudden now, if you add, you've got this behavioral finance tool and we position it in a way that sounds like, you know, wow, nobody's ever done this with me. Nobody's ever cared. Nobody's ever been this dedicated. Or we take this, the relationship, the ability to create trust. And I read this incredible quote the other day that marketing these days is cheap, but trust is more expensive.
Trust is really
expensive. We're talking about making trust a lot less expensive with the things that you're talking about and that we're talking about. And I think that's an incredible opportunity for advisors, and I hope they're paying attention.
Well, and Kirk, too, just to add to that is we always want advisors. In fact, you and I were just talking about a mutual potential client that you had worked with years ago, and you said, but Matt, they're not any different than anybody else. And I kept pushing back and said, but they've got to be different than everybody else. And Prasad, this seems to me to be a game changing difference. And that's why we were so happy to have you on the podcast today, because we love bringing thought leadership like yours to advisors to show them that there are ways to come across to your clients as fundamentally unique and different and change the conversation.
Sure. And most importantly, right, what we are also trying to do here is we are trying to provide, I mean, forget the marketing aspect for a sec, right? Forget the market differentiation aspect and all the related benefits. At the core of what we are trying to do is we are trying to help build a great relationship between a financial advisor and the client, so the financial advisor can do a great job in delivering the perfect portfolio that's behaviorally suited for a client. So that's at the crux of what we are trying to do. Hmm. In a sense that it's because, again, if you talk about, like, say, for example, marketing and behavioral science, some people believe that there is a negative connotation to like psychologically manipulating, you know, other people or psychologically manipulating your clients into buying your service. This is not that at all. What I call this is it's almost like a good nudge, you know, like Richard Taylor of Yale University puts it. He says that it's not wrong to nudge your clients in the right direction if it's for their good.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Yep.
So that is at the center of what we are trying to do. We want people, because if you think about financial planning and take a step back and look at the issues surrounding financial planning, if you're in your, say, 30s or 40s and you don't end up building a strong, credible, disciplined financial plan for the next 15, 20 years, then there's a very, very good chance that when you're closer to retirement, you will probably be looking at other sources such as government payouts and stuff like that to support yourself. And that's not a good place to be in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea is we try to create awareness for individuals, for investors, that you need to do something and you need to be serious about your financial planning. And the way I put it is, if you, for example, are the kind of person, you know, who spends 3-4 hours on Facebook and social media every day, but you don't spend 15-20 minutes on, say, Wall Street Journal or the Economic Times and stuff like that, then you probably need professional financial advice, right? Now, I'll give you one more example. If you take me, right, I mean, I have about 18 years of financial quantitative experience. But you know what? I have a financial advisor too.
Hmm.
Yeah, and the reason for that is not because I don't have the knowledge or I don't have the skill set, but having a financial advisor, even for people like me who are like really well-versed in the markets, it helps me to stay disciplined. Hmm. And it helps me to like have a second opinion. So whenever, before I take a financial call, be it an investment in a stock or a mutual fund or even a real estate issue, I always pick up the phone and talk to my financial advisor and say, hey, what do you think about this? And my financial advisor obviously has a great relationship with me and he knows me behaviorally. So he plays the right kind of a devil's advocate type of role to kind of point me and make me look at things that I might have missed.
Hmm.
So if this is the case for professional investors, then this becomes a lot more important for people who are not financially or capital market savvy.
You know what I find really incredible about everything that you're doing, Prasad, is you have how many tools and or concepts out there for advisors not only help you attract clients, but actually keep clients and add a ton of value along the way and have a better experience.
And more importantly, you know, just one more thing to add there, we are also able to optimize the resource allocation for a financial advisory firm. So for example, let's assume that Matt and Kirk, you know, run this fantastic financial advisory firm called Matt and Kirk Financial Advisors, right? And, you know, you have like your two people, you have a bunch of prospects that you go and talk to, and then you have like, say, a list of like, say, 30, 40 existing clients. Now, your typical cycle would be to go to your existing clients and try to get referrals, right? And then, Kirk, you've written a fantastic paper on getting referrals. But then a lot of people approach referrals from a very wrong angle, and it ends up actually being a problem, and they don't really get enough referrals. Now, if you think about this, if you go and give this particular assessment to your existing clients, right, and then they take a look at it, and then they, you know, they like it, they may not like it, whatever it is, then you go and tell them, would some of your acquaintances be interested in taking this assessment? Now, that's a much easier ask, and that's a much easier way for them to give you some contacts than going and asking them, hey, can you refer me to people that I can go and pitch my financial advisory services to? Mm-hmm. That could get a little awkward, right?
Absolutely. It's one of the reasons that we love offering podcasting services to advisors, is because it's so much easier for a client to be inspired, and it's easier for them to say, hey, you know, I have my financial advisor, I've been wanting to introduce them for a long time. You should go listen to their podcast. Mm-hmm. That is so easy to do. It's the same thing with your assessment. It's so easy. It's not a big ask, not much of a commitment. And there's only value that can be seen on the other side. So it's great.
Well, it's also building an enormous amount of trust too, right? When I refer one of my friends to the Syntonic site to be able to do this or use these tools, when my friends go through these questions, they're going to think to themselves, nobody's ever asked me these questions before, right? And Kirk, when we talk about the podcast aspect of this, it's so this could be coupled very well with what we're talking about, because not only do you realize that the advisor is saying and asking truly unique and different questions, but then they can tune into a podcast that talks about the sort of stuff that Prasad is talking about. And then they're going to be like, wow. So not only do I get to feel and hear and connect with them verbally, auditorially, but I'm also going to be able to do it through these questions. And so for the sake of time, two things. Number one, Prasad, we've got to have you back. And one of the things I would love to do on another podcast is really dive into the report and how you can use that for business development and build deeper relationships with existing clients. So if you don't mind, I'd love to have you back on that. But just to kind of wrap things up, let's do some closing thoughts. So Prasad, give us some closing thoughts here.
Okay, in terms of closing thoughts, I think, I mean, forget Syntonic and forget my assessment and all that for a sec. I think it is extremely important for financial advisors to understand their clients' behaviors. And that should be the key for any type of investment strategies or portfolio strategies going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is we provide a very, very simple way of doing that so you don't end up spending tons of time and effort and research on trying to figure out what your clients' investment behaviors are. And then we also help you, again, from a compliance perspective, for an advisor to see if the things that they are suggesting to a prospective client, if that's, you know, if it's really suitable for that particular investor. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different angles to this. And it also boils down to, like, for example, let's assume as an advisor, you send this to, like, say, 10, 15 people. And then out of these 10, 15 people, only, like, say, 5 people take the assessment. That immediately tells you that instead of chasing 15 people, you just speak to these 5 people because they are self-motivated enough to take the assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are probably behaviorally coachable because you need the right type of clients too. You don't want clients who are difficult to sit down and have a chat with, right? So it helps in a variety of different ways. And at the core of all this is to make you a better financial advisor and have better relationships with your clients.
Hmm. Kirk, what are your closing thoughts?
Well, I think of the thousands of people who are going to download and or listen to this podcast, there's probably like 2 to 3 who are really hoping that we don't end the call knowing who won the bet.
Well, okay. So it's very clear I won that bet. But you know, outside of that, what are your closing thoughts? You're just going to have to buy me a beer, dude.
So I have no idea, but... about who won that bet, but I'll give it to you.
All right.
I think that marketing, there's a lot of different ways to get your message out there, create value for your clients. And I think that this is a very compelling opportunity. It's just like podcasting. It's like, you know, not everybody's doing it. You know, behavioral finance assessments, not everybody's doing them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them who are using ones that I don't like as much as this one. And I think it's you can't not ignore this after listening to this podcast. So I think what we need to do is we need to understand Prasad.
Sure.
How people can, you know, check this out, learn more about it.
Absolutely.
In a way that, you know, and you're not the kind of guy that's going to be, you know, heavy sales. So I think they can feel real good about, you know, not being burdened by that.
Sure. One thing that I just want to add to this conversation before we close is, you know, given that you guys have done a fantastic job of having me on, you know, here today, and I'm very thankful for that, I'm going to give the listeners to this podcast a great offer. So if you go to www.syntonic.com, and that's syntonic.com, and then you can go through the financial advisors page, and there is a registration where you can actually try out the product for free without even, you know, paying a cent or even entering any kind of credit card information. Now, if you like it, and because you have come through this particular podcast, I can offer them a 50% discount for the first 1 year. And all they have to do is to just enter AAA in the referral code. So there's a section for the registration form where it says referral code. And all they have to do is enter AAA, AAA. So that way I will know that they have come through after listening to this particular podcast.
Did you say 15.15%?
50. Yeah, 50 for the.
I didn't know. I didn't know that you were doing this because it's not a requirement to be on our show. But
no, but look, I mean, it's been gracious. A great show. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a great show. So I just wanted to, like, give something back.
Well, we are all about giving stuff back, Prasad. And thank you for your time today. Thank you for, you know, really opening up these doors, because as an ex-therapist myself, and I've been teaching financial advisors to have different conversations for years, and I never had a tool like this. I mean, we had some tools, but nothing that dove as deeply into the results of behavioral bias and how to attack those as what you've created. So, hey, guys, thank you very much for all of your time today. Kirk, thanks for joining us from Toronto.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much for having me today. Really enjoyed the conversation.
All right, Prasad. And all the way from Dubai, we just did our first multi-continental podcast. So thank you for that.
Excellent.
And this was episode number 28, Why Advisors Should Care About Behavioral Finance with Prasad Ramani. Thanks, guys, and we'll talk soon.
Sure. Take care. Bye-bye.